Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated island-chained paradise in the Fukushima sun, where everybody likes to sunbathe by soaking up the rays. And my very special guest is Catherine Albrecht, not to be confused with Kellogg's Allbran, although she is high in moral fiber. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. It's great to hear from you. That's the first time I've heard that one. That's pretty clever.
I told my wife that this morning. She says, "Don't use it. It's too lame."
I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. So I like the high in moral fiber too. I've been thinking a lot about, I don't know, how we try to maintain that in what seems like just an ocean of filth and corruption that seems to just get worse every day, and given some thought about what we need to turn off and maybe spend less time doing and involved in, because right now it's just like a torrent of negativity and fear-provoking and I don't know, corruption-inducing media that we're all consuming out there. So I have been thinking about moral fiber, and I think that's very appropriate.
Oh, yeah. I'm just sick of the scumbaggery, you know, personally.
It's quite crazy. And I don't think the scumbaggery is new. I think it's always been that way. I think there's always been corruption, and people in positions of power have always tried to exercise that power to advance their own desires and at the expense of other people. But I think what's happening now is it seems like some stuff that used to be restricted to very strange subcultures and to underground interests have now become very, very mainstream. And this obsession with killing, this obsession with darkness and demonic themes and all the things that we're seeing in television and movies and video games, that's relatively new, I think. I think people have always had an interest in those things, but they didn't have the ability to consume them 24/7 like they do now, and they didn't have them coming at them from 100 different directions like they do today. So I've really been thinking about places where in my own life I want to limit my media consumption and maybe try to clean house a little bit when it just comes to my own mind and my own psychological state, realizing that's really influenced by the stuff we take in. It's that old garbage in, garbage out thing they talk about with computer programming. Your brain is just a big computer, and if you put a lot of garbage in it, you're probably going to start getting garbage coming back out again, and we're seeing that in society too.
Yeah, I've actually just stopped watching TV. I mean, we switched over from UHF to digital, right? And I couldn't be bothered getting myself a digital decoder so I could keep watching TV. So I just don't do that anymore. And
it's interesting, Vinny. Most of the most interesting, thoughtful, and effective people I know have given up television. So I'm not surprised at all to hear you say that. Whenever I find somebody who's a really powerful activist or an advocate or someone who's really a mover and a shaker in the world, I have lately taken to asking them how much television they watch. And the answer is almost I'd say at least half the time, they say, well, I got rid of television. I don't have it at all. So I think there is something to be said for that, because the average American is spending, get this, you ready for a statistic that will blow your mind? The average American is spending 11 hours a day, and I'm sure in New Zealand it's similar, engaging with one type of screen, technology screen or another. And so whether that's television, whether that is video games, whether that is
smartphones,
Facebook, whatever that is, smartphones, absolutely, 11 hours a day. Now, let's do the math. We've got 24 hours in a day. You spend 8 of them sleeping if you want to be healthy. That leaves 24 minus 8. That leaves you with 16 waking hours left. If you're spending 11 of those 16 hours staring into a screen, that's about 70% of your waking time. And the time that you're spending doing that is time that you're not spending doing other things like interacting with people around you, exercising, looking at the stars, making love, all the sorts of things that make a human. If you're spending all that time staring into a screen instead, that time, I hate to say it, but for the most part, is being wasted. Time you spend staring at a TV is filling your head with something. I know a lot of people who say, oh, well, I justify my TV because I watch the Discovery Channel and the History Channel. And I say, well, how much of that really, if you could actually look at a log of your television time, how much of your TV time really is spent doing that? And even if it is, should you really be spending all, I mean, if you're that much of a history buff, go get a degree in history. Go contribute to historical knowledge. Go do something meaningful instead of just passively absorbing stuff through a TV.
Mm. Well, and then there's the other element as well, which is the YouTube University. Oh my God, how much knowledge did I accumulate geometrically because I sat there day after day watching like 2-3 documentaries per day?
It's crazy. And, you know, I was thinking about this. You just hit on something I was thinking about just last night for the first time this has ever dawned on me. There's a passage in the Bible that talks about as we approach the end, as things start getting really out of control, that knowledge will be greatly increased and people will travel to and fro. And for the longest time, people thought knowledge will be greatly increased. What does that even mean? And I thought, my gosh, today, anything I want to know. You want to know the population of Panama? I could tell you that in 30 seconds. I'll go to Start Page. I won't go to Google. Helped create Start Page, the private search engine. But I can go to Panama and tell you, I can't go to Panama. Maybe that's next in the technology here where I can instantaneously just be there. But I can look at pictures of Panama. I can look at videos of Panama. I can tell you what it feels like to walk down a Panama street by going on YouTube and looking up, you know, videos of Panama streets. If you think back to the time before we had these technologies, if you had told Christopher Columbus, for example, that rather than getting in on a ship and sailing across the ocean and going to some whole new place, that he could just sit in one place and look at a rectangle, a flat rectangle, and in this flat rectangle he could actually see what it feels like or see what these places look like, he wouldn't have believed you. It would have been inconceivable that you could know the sound of a foreign language, that you could hear the voice of someone on the other side of the globe instantaneously, that you could see and know and hear and experience all of these things. And the thing is, Vinny, what's coming next, it's really important that we recognize we're not at the end point of this. We're at the beginning point of this. So what's going to happen next, things we consider inconceivable, like being able to smell what that street looks like, to be able to feel the cobblestones under your feet, to be able to go on a future equivalent of YouTube and want to know what the Peruvian food tastes like or whatever country you're looking at, and actually be able to push a button and feel the experience of crunching on some kind of crunchy meal that they provide and having the full neurological experience of tasting. All of this stuff is being worked on right now. But the next step is going to be this Oculus Rift. Have you heard about this eyewear? It's kind of like Google Glass, but it's creepier. It's a gaming device that you strap on your head, and it's like a big pair of goggles that straps right under your head. And it also has an accelerometer, which is the device inside of a smartphone that lets the smartphone tell if you're holding it vertically or horizontally. It detects motion. So you put this thing on your head, and you can watch videos of people doing this. Again, knowledge greatly increased, even about the knowledge increasing. So you can watch a video of this, and you can see people putting on this Oculus Rift, and what you experience inside of this device on your face is that when you move your head to the left, the video game environment that you're viewing through the Oculus Rift eye screen moves to the left. When you look up, it's as though you're looking up the ceiling of the fake room, the virtual reality room that you're in. When you look down, you see your own virtual reality lap and legs. Or if you're walking and you look down in the game, you see your feet moving forward, one foot, the other foot. When you turn to the right, you see what's to the right. When people strap this thing on and they run a program of a roller coaster, people have actually gotten sick and thrown up because the sensation of motion is so real that they really feel as though, I mean, they reach out and try to grab onto things. They scream when the roller coaster starts going downhill. This level of virtual reality, again, it's not the latest thing. I guess it is the latest thing, but it's the beginning, not the end. So what's going to happen next is all of these, they're figuring out ways to connect the human nervous system, basically take you out of this real physical world and put you into this other world where you're being stimulated with impressions of having experiences that you're not really having. And this gets back to this 11 hours a day of screen time. What are you doing during those 11 hours if you're playing video games? Let's say you're playing Call of Duty or Halo 3 or Grand Theft Auto. What are you doing all those hours? Well, you're essentially, if you take away the screen itself, you're sitting in a chair. You are, or maybe you're reclining on a sofa. Maybe you're lying on the floor with pillows. But you are basically a couch potato. You're staring at a spot in the middle of space. On which really nothing's happening. If you take it away, you're just staring at the wall. And yet your mind is having all of these very intense emotional, physical, psychological, and neurological experiences while your body just sits there like a lump. And what we've been finding now is that when you spend a lot of time in these environments, it has direct effects actually on the functioning of the brain. If young people developing in their childhood and in their teens spend a lot of time playing violent video games, two things happen to them, and the video game producers have been promoting this as the greatest thing ever. Their visual acuity increases. Their ability to see and quickly respond to things increases. Their reaction time increases. And you would say, well, that's really a good thing. The problem is that at the same time your reaction time increases, the normal thing in a human brain, in your brain, in my brain, assuming you're not a huge killer video game addict, the normal thing in our brains that stops us from acting impulsively without thinking is being basically deadened in people who play these games. So let me give you an example. Let's say that I am a Second Amendment advocate and I own a gun, which I do, by the way, in which I am. And let's say an intruder comes into my backyard. And I live in the country. If there were somebody in my backyard, I would have a momentary, yikes, who's that? Normal behavior would be to stop, not to go and get a gun and shoot that person, but to stop and say, who is that? What are they doing? I wonder why they're in my yard. Maybe I would yell out the window, hello, who are you? Why are you here? Right? That's because the impulse control part of my brain, which immediately responds with fight or flight, is able to stop and intellectually process what's really happening before I respond. Now, in the case of people who've been playing lots of violent video games, the same thing that makes their reaction time really fast also makes them much more likely to respond instantaneously without that impulse control moment of let me figure out what's going on and think this through first. And so we're finding that, and you may not realize this, my doctorate from Harvard is actually in developmental psychology. So I spent a lot of time studying child development and media exposure. And one of the things that we're finding in the research is that when kids play these games for long spans of time, that their impulse control, their ability to not immediately respond when something bad happens in their life is greatly reduced. So this means if you've got, let's say, a 15-year-old boy who plays Call of Duty all day long and is constantly having enemies pop up in the game that he has to instantly shoot. In fact, the game is about quick response time. If you stop, then that enemy will kill you. So you got to see the enemy, and without even thinking, you pull the trigger. Now that 15-year-old goes to school, and somebody makes him mad. Well, without even thinking, he's going to respond. He may respond with a verbal outburst. He may respond by punching somebody. He may respond by picking something up and throwing it on the ground or becoming violent. But the normal response that you or I would have, somebody makes you mad and you think, I'd like to punch you in the nose, but you know what? I think I won't. Let me instead take a more mature response. That momentary reflection called impulse control isn't occurring. So as we expand this out, these young people, now we're seeing it in young people, we're going to pretty soon start seeing this in young people who've become adults, who have the ability, who are big enough and strong enough and weapon-enabled to actually act on these thoughts. And let me tell you the scariest part of the literature that I've been researching in the last, I don't know, couple of months. I'm thinking about writing a book on this topic. So the scariest thing I'm finding is this rash of teenage boys, primarily, it's mostly boys, not girls, teenage boys who the parents tell them something that they don't want to hear, like take out the garbage or do your homework or no, you can't go out with your friends. But most often it's I'm going to take away the video game that you're addicted to. That's usually the thing the kid doesn't want to hear. And these kids, because of the way they've been grounded in violence, because of the way that they've already killed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in cold blood in these movies, they respond by killing their parents. And then afterwards, and I've been listening to the 911 calls and reading the transcripts and reading these kids' confessions after they commit these crimes and kill their own parents, they themselves are horrified at their behavior. They themselves say, I can't believe what a monster I've become. What kind of kid kills their own mother? What kind of kid would do this? I guess I've just become evil. These kids can't even understand their own behavior. They're shocked at what they themselves have done. There's this awful, heartbreaking video of a kid in the back of a patrol car after he's been arrested. He's being taken off to jail for killing his parents. And this kid is in the back of the car, and he's screaming, I didn't mean to do it. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do it. Oh, my gosh, how did I kill my parents? I can't believe I did this. And he's just crying and sobbing, sobbing and crying. And you think, this is a kid who didn't premeditate. Gee, I really wish my parents were dead, so let me plot for a month and figure out the best way to do it. This is a kid who had no impulse control. His parents came in and took away his video game, and he killed him. And he didn't think it through. The normal impulse control that keeps you from killing people who make you mad didn't kick in and didn't work for that kid. And now the kid himself is horrified because whatever impulse control should have been there, it is now haunting him afterwards. You shouldn't have done that. But it's too late for those parents. And here's the problem. We're seeing it over and over and over. It's like an epidemic. Once you search for this and you realize it's happening, you'll find examples. There's two girls who poisoned their parents, poisoned them with poison because they couldn't get on Facebook. So they poisoned the parents and waited for the parents. They actually gave them an overdose of sleeping medication. They waited for the parents to totally fall asleep and conk out, and then they overrode their parents' restriction on their Facebook use and went on Facebook. Killing your parents or poisoning your parents to try to get on Facebook? Yikes. And then there are other people. I know you're in New Zealand. I know you guys have a lot of gun control down there. There are people who say, well, this is all about guns. If we just took the guns away from the kids, we'd be fine. What we're finding is when kids don't have guns, they use frying pans. They use claw hammers. They use rocks. They'll kill their parents in these circumstances with whatever is at hand. It doesn't have to be a gun. It could be anything. So what is it that's happening to our society? And this is really about unplugging, where we have got young people who are so addicted to these games and being so corrupted in their psychological development. And the games are pleasurable. That's why you play them, of course. They give you pleasure. We are associating in our society, in the minds of the most vulnerable members of our society, children, we are associating killing with pleasure. See, that's a huge part of this. If a kid sits there all day long playing a video game that he loves so much he won't even get up and leave, and he's addicted, and the rush of endorphins and the rush of positive emotions that he's having, all of those addictive chemicals in his head are associated with the maximum number of people that he can kill on the screen. It is not surprising to me that we are having these young people now go out and take guns and kill lots of people in real life. Do they know the outcome of what's going to happen to them? Probably not. I was just reading about a 17-year-old boy who was obsessed with the Halloween series of movies. Michael Myers, I guess, is the guy in there. And he's this horrifying murderer. And this kid got angry with his sister and his parents because he said they were, quote, racist. He was white, and they made some comments about somebody of another race. And he said, well, that's really terrible. That's not PC. My parents are disgusting. My sister's disgusting. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to kill them. And he took a cue from the Halloween movie and tried to replicate a killing scene in the film. And he said, I was amazed. When I watched the film, I was amazed. And I want to key in on this word. He said, when I watched Halloween, I was amazed at how the killer was able to kill without any remorse. And I thought it would be the same way for me. And yet when I did kill my sister and my mother, it was horrifying. It was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I will never do it again. I totally regret it. It wasn't that way at all, and yuck. So here's the part. I was amazed. So here's a kid who's watching Halloween. Why his parents had this film in the house or let him watch it, I don't even know. Why anybody would watch it, why anybody would make this movie, I don't know. But he watches this film in which a cold-blooded killer kills members of his own family, coldly kills a whole bunch of people. It's terrifying. But he does it in a way that is so calm, cool, and collected that you view him, I guess if you're this teenager, as a hero. Here's a guy who can go into a really stressful situation, like murdering someone, and just be cool as a cucumber as though it didn't even faze him. I'm going to be cool like that guy, too. I'm going to kill my sister. I'm going to kill my mom. And I'm just going to walk away like you know, James Dean. I'm going to be so cool. See, the amazed part is what gets me about his confession. He actually wrote that in a lengthy confession. He confesses, I was amazed at how he could do these killings with no remorse. So amazed is the interesting word. He's watching fiction. He's watching something fake. But the thing that makes fiction so powerful and that makes horror movies so horrifying and scary is your brain thinks they're real. You're operating on multiple psychological levels when you're exposed.
Well, that's why bugger all people went swimming in the late 1970s because the movie Jaws came out.
They wouldn't go in the water, right? So they know it's fiction, but there's still a part of the brain that says scary stuff is real. My own mother really is reluctant to take showers, any shower with a shower curtain. As are literally millions of women.
Because she saw Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's movie, right? Yeah.
That's right. And see, if you think of Psycho, you could watch it now, and it's just so tame by today's standards. You don't even get to see the blood and the gore. You just see the indications of it. Nowadays, I shudder to think what's in people's heads. But my own mom, like I said, to this day, how many years later, she's an older woman now, she will not go in the shower because of Psycho. So when we watch these films, this is really important for parents especially to understand. When your children watches a film, when your child watches a film, there's a part of them and of you and of all of us that says, well, this isn't real. So this is how you can sit in a theater, Vinny, and watch Psycho and not get up and run away. When the thing starts happening, you're not running away because a part of you, your executive function knows that that's a screen and that you're in a seat in theater and that the thing on the screen cannot actively harm you. But there's another part
of your mind. Well, that said, some films are so horrifying and compelling that people will literally run out of the theater screaming. the original Alien in 1979, there were people puking up in the aisles, people fainting in their seats, people running screaming from the cinema.
Well, that's actually, you make a really, really good point. And we view that as being so naive, and to be really mature would be to be able to just sit in your seat and tolerate that and not throw up or run away. But I'll have to research that. I'll include it in my book here. But there is a part of you that is kind of immobilized as you're experiencing these things. But there's another part of you that is absorbing every bit of it. And the reason for that is whether you believe in evolution, creation, whatever your worldview is, human beings, however long they have been here, have not been exposed to artificial visions of things occurring that weren't really real, unless they were hallucinating or had a high fever. For the most part, if you see one person in front of you killing another person throughout all of human history and all of our mental and psychological development as human beings, that always meant that you were witnessing real violence. If anything that you saw happening in front of you involving real people was perceived as a reality. And now that we suddenly have this new fake way of seeing reality, we like to convince ourselves that we're mature enough to not be able to confuse the two. But the brain is not. The brain is not able to distinguish those things. This is why people who watch a lot of this kind of fare will have terrible nightmares. This is why they'll have a different view of the scariness of the real world. It's like what you were talking about, Jaws.
Well, and also, this is another reason why a lot of people watching plenty of Alex Jones documentaries start to go a little bit nuts and afraid and really angry and stuff all the time, because the things that they're seeing are actually real, and they think that the threat's right there in front of them, kind of thing. Like, oh my God, they're trying to exterminate me, you know?
Yes, it's absolutely right. And so the reality is, sharks do eat people in the ocean. Sharks do attack people, but it doesn't happen very often. And if you watch a film in which sharks are attacking people all the time, then you will believe that every time you go in the ocean, a shark's going to eat you. If CNN and Fox News and CBS News and all the mainstream, lamestream media is showing you all day long terrorists blowing up buildings and terrorists harming people, then you're going to believe that under every rock there's a terrorist hiding to blow you up. If you don't watch television, it's interesting. People who watch a lot of TV, regardless of what kind of TV, and people who don't watch any TV like you and me, if you compare them and you survey them, and I know because I did this at Harvard, I did this with kids. I surveyed kids who did and didn't watch TV, and I asked them questions like, think about your town, and it would be like Watertown, Massachusetts. And I would say, think about your town. How many people do you think were killed in your town last week? And the people who didn't watch TV would say, well, probably none. The kids who did watch TV would say, I don't know, 30 or 40? I'm not making this up. They would just have this completely unrealistic notion of how deadly Watertown, Massachusetts, which is it's a blue-collar community. It's very low-key. Everybody works, and it doesn't have any crime. I mean, it has some crime, but it certainly doesn't have 40 murders a week.
Yeah. It's not a frickin' suburb in South Africa, is it?
There you go. Exactly. There's places where, I don't know. But you can ask people who watch TV about the threat of really anything. A meteor hitting the earth, a fire breaking out and killing them personally, rapists coming through their door and harming them. And in all cases, these things that they see on television, their sense of how real those threats are is vastly, vastly, vastly over-exaggerated. And if you ask people who don't watch TV, they're much closer in line with reality, with the actual real numbers of these things really happening.
Well, this is quite strange for me because not only did my TV just it's now under the house, don't even watch it at all, but also my car radio broke. So and I don't read articles or really anything from mainstream media. So I've almost phased out mainstream media entirely from my life. And when people ask me, and this actually kind of goes to your point, I have a lot of people who are think a lot like I do, but they still watch TV, they still watch mainstream media, they're not unplugged from it. And they ask me all these questions about all of these things that are happening in current events, and I not only don't know the answers, I also know that the answers are actually irrelevant because nothing that the mainstream media tells you actually is usually of any import anyway.
I have had the same experience with politics. That's where it's really gotten me over the last couple of years. That back in 1999, when I first became an activist, my husband and I got very much involved in libertarian politics, and we thought we could change the world because this is how the media tells you the world gets changed. The media tells you that the world is changed by politicians. But the reality is that there is no power there for you. You have no power to change the world, either from the ballot box or from getting yourself elected, unless you do it on a local level. And local politics, I think, is where there's a huge amount of power. I think if we're going to see any kind of change from politics, it's going to be from the ground up. But getting yourself elected, first of all, they'll make sure that you don't. Look at Ron Paul in 2008 and again in 2012. Ron Paul had the majority of people who cared anything about politics at all in this country. Ron Paul was it. And they made sure that he didn't even make it on the ballot in many states. They did all kinds of underhanded, sneaky things. I know because I saw them happening right here in New Hampshire, which is one of the key political states at the beginning of the political season. So I watched it with my own eyes. We went, my husband and I went, because Ron Paul was registered as a Democrat at that time, and we went to the Democratic local, whatever that thing, the straw poll, that's what they called it. We went to the straw poll, and a whole bunch of us went who were Republicans who went to vote for Ron Paul, and they canceled the straw poll when they saw our numbers. They literally canceled it. They said, you can't, no straw poll today. We said, well, why not? And they didn't have a reason for it. So, well, we never really were going to do it anyway. Yeah, you were. I have an email right here that says to come at 6 p.m. for the straw poll. So we saw things like this happening over and over and over and over. And so it's really a challenge to get somebody who is really going to change the system, who's not really part of the system, to become elected to any kind of position of authority or power, because they'll make sure it doesn't happen. And if it does happen by some wild, miraculous possibility, then those people tend to get assassinated. So I actually believe, I think for Ron Paul's sake, it's probably good he didn't get elected president, because I don't think he would have lived out his term. I literally don't. So you've got this issue of the mainstream media telling you the place where change is made is at the ballot box, because it's really the politicians who are setting the pace. And you and I know, of course, Vinny, that the politicians are puppets on a string, that they are actors mouthing the roles and mouthing the scripts that they're given by people far more powerful and hidden than they are. So there's no chance that a politician at a high level is going to have any kind of power to make things better.
Well, because you can't allow people into those positions to have unchecked power in their own degree, right? Let's say you already own the country and you own the major corporations and you distribute its money. What is the likelihood that somebody in that kind of a position of power would give any power at all to somebody who they can't blackmail or control?
That's right. It won't happen. And you want to know an interesting, you probably know this story, but Aaron Russo, who was a good friend of mine and who directed the film America from Freedom to Fascism, which really launched the Ron Paul Revolution in 2008, and which I had the blessed good fortune to actually be in that film. Aaron Russo was friends with the Rockefellers, and on his deathbed, he actually told me this story while he was alive, and then on his deathbed he confirmed that it was true. He was friends with one of the Rockefeller sons back in the day when he was a big-time Hollywood movie producer working with Bette Midler and Eddie Murphy and all these people. And he was smoking pot with one of the Rockefellers, and the guy turns to him and says, "Would you like to be a governor?" And he said, "I don't know, I'm just a filmmaker." And the guy says, "Well, pick a state. We have a couple available. If you'd like to be a governor, just let me know." And he names off some of the states that they could give to Aaron Russo that he could become the governor of. I'm going to say, wow, I didn't realize it worked that way, because wouldn't you think that maybe they could get him on the ballot, perhaps? And then he'd have to go in a race that he might not win, but it's not like that. This was back in the 70s that they were just going to hand him a governorship. And so it's not surprising then when you see these family dynasties, you know, all the Bushes getting governorships and all the Kennedys getting all these positions. It's because they're handed out by people who have the power and the ability to simply hand them out. And, of course, if you took the governorship of, say, Arizona, then you better believe that your job now is going to be answering to your masters who put you in that position. And the minute you say, heck no, I'm the governor, I don't have to do what you tell me, Rockefeller family.
Boom, right in the head.
You're going to find yourself, what?
Boom, right in the head.
Yeah, exactly. A bullet in the head, or, and I think this is the more civilized way that they've been
doing it. A sex scandal.
A huge scandal, exactly. And they set you up for the scandal. So we'll give you the governorship, and we'll give you a whole bunch of hookers, and we'll give you an affair, and we'll let you use drugs, and we'll let you do all these things, and you're going to be living the high life. But we've got the goods on you. And the minute you turn and say to us no, then all of that stuff's going to come out, and you are going to be absolutely taken from power. Mm. Don't you wonder what happened to General Petraeus here in the U.S., where his affair with I can't remember her name, but he's involved in this affair, and he is the head of U.S. military intelligence. If anybody was in a position to know how to remain hidden or have an affair and have it be hidden, it'd be him. So you have to ask yourself, what did he do that caused them to reveal that information? Because, you know, half of Washington is having an affair. These aren't people with any more.
And that's a conservative estimate.
I would say that is a conservative estimate. So you've got all these people having affairs. Why aren't we getting scandal after scandal every single day until we clean up the mess?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because they save the scandals until the person that they want to take out of power does something they don't like. And then they'll say, hey, listen, you play ball with us, or your affair with that little cutie down the, you know, down the hall is going to be front page news tomorrow in the New York Times. And apparently most of them play ball. There are some who don't. And anytime I see a scandal like that erupting and the media jumping all over it and it becoming a huge story, I say, what did that person do to make their masters angry? And I still don't know with David Petraeus. I don't know what he
did. Have you ever played the opposite game? You sit there and you watch the news, and everything that they say, you just pretend it's the exact opposite. It's a really freaky game.
I think people in the Soviet Union had to do that for sure. I think some of the stuff that they... I think they give us enough truth to keep us believing and coming back. I think it's really, it's like they poison the pot. They give you maybe 9 stories out of 10, but if you followed them up, they're kind of sort of true. And then that one absolute doozy of a lie. And because it's being served up to you in the same format with the same talking heads and the same degree of seriousness or levity as the case may be, you just go, and swallow it. Now, when I say you, I don't mean you, Vinny, but people do.
And, I totally
Michael
do.
Rivero, who runs What Really Happened, Michael Rivero once said something so brilliant that it keeps sticking in my head. He once said that the reason your friends and family and associates who just say, no matter how much evidence you show them, that something is corrupt or something's not the way you're being told, they will keep going back and saying, well, but Fox News says da-da-da-da-da, or this authority says blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. Even if you can prove that what they're saying is false, they keep saying it, and they keep going back to it, and they stick their fingers in their ears and say, I can't hear you, right? Like people about 9/11 who absolutely refuse to look at any kind of evidence whatsoever the ballistic evidence, but that's not the word I want. There's all kinds of evidence that 9/11 is not what we were told. And yet when you try to show this to, say, your mother-in-law or your brother-in-law, they just don't want to hear it.
I think the quickest thing with 9/11 is, hey, have you got 7 seconds? Sure. Have a look at this giant skyscraper that comes down in free fall speed on 9/11. What's that? It's Building 7. Holy crap.
There you go. And yet nobody talks about it. So you can show that to somebody and they'll say, I don't know, I can't see that. And even if, let's say, Fox News said, well, Building 7 came down because there was a meteor that hit it, and which would be utter nonsense. Everybody would know that that was utter nonsense. But you know that you've got some friend, some associate, some golf buddy, some fishing buddy, some brother-in-law, somebody who would say, well, I can't hear you because Fox News said a meteor hit it. And you'd say, well, what kind of meteor? What are you talking about? That's nonsense. Well, Fox News said it. All right, well, Michael Rivero helped me understand this. It was really helpful to me, and I'm going to paraphrase. He basically said that people want to be told lies that they can later point to as authority, even as they know it is a lie, because it gets them off the hook of having to actually deal with what it would mean if that thing were true. So if Fox News said a meteor hit Building 7, and your brother-in-law said, yeah, well, it was a meteor. And you say, well, no meteor here. Let's look at the meteorological report. I don't want to see that. Fox News said it was a meteor. The reason he's doing that, even if on some level he figures out that Fox News totally lied about that, he's going to hang on to it because it gives him an excuse in the face of you to not have to acknowledge what you're saying. And once I understood that there are people out there who intentionally want to be lied to. And the media knows that, the people who run the media at least. And so that's why they serve these compelling lies that are good stories, even if they're full of holes, and even if a common sense, intelligent person would see that they're lies. They serve them up anyway.
Why do they call it common sense? Why do they call it common sense? It's certainly uncommon. I call it platinum sense because it's one of the rarest elements.
That's a good phrase. I like that. Common sense. But this has helped me understand a lot, because there are times when the media lies to you and you don't quite figure it out. There are times when the media lies to you and it's like, what? What kind of stupid idiot is going to believe that? And yet it's not that anybody really believes it. But it gives them the excuse to not have to deal with it.
Oh, the Barack Obama speech is a classic, you know. I'm going to create jobs in the economy.
Well, if you like your health insurance, you can keep your health insurance. I'm a victim.
I'm going to pull the troops out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, I could have swear if he actually did that speech, but he just put an ironic tone on it and a sly grin every time he said it, he could do stand-up comedy, like totally.
I'm telling you. No, it's, I don't know if you heard that my health insurance, actually, I'm a breast cancer survivor, and my health insurance in the state of New Hampshire, thanks to Obamacare, is taking away all of my coverage, basically all my ability to see any of my doctors. If I had developed breast cancer under Obamacare, I would be dead today. It's truly shocking.
Well, you know, Obamacare becomes Obama don't care.
That's a good phrase.
Like Jimmy Crack Corn. Jimmy Crack Corn and Obama don't care.
There you go. Yeah, so I think we're going to see a big rebellion against that. At least I hope we do. And I don't know. I'm staying tuned. My insurance got extended for a year, but if it hadn't been, I wouldn't be able to receive any of the treatment that I'm currently receiving, which I paid good money for insurance to have.
Well, and there's other elements. Like there's so many cancer cures out there that it's just not even funny. I mean, I think I've looked at like nearly 100 different cancer cures that have been evidenced by what are they called? It's not the Pulitzer Prize, the Nobel Prize winners and things like that. Like intravenous vitamin C alone, because cancer's a virus and vitamin C is a viricide, you pump 50 grams full of vitamin C intravenously into your body, it'll kill that cancer really, really easily. There's the Rick Simpson cannabis oil method, which is shown to have pretty much success on every condition that is being given to, even people with depression or spinal fractures or anything like that, just heals them right up. And the problem with the medical system is, of course, you're probably well aware, is that the Rockefellers own it, as well as the rest of America.
Well, I think they own it because it's big bucks. That's certainly. I don't think they own it because they're trying to kill everybody. They certainly want to keep the herd healthy to the extent it's useful to them. But it's definitely where the money is.
Well, there was a study. There was a study that was released not too long ago, and I think the American medical system was supposed to be killing, I think it was one person every 60 seconds, and then they did a review, and they said, well, actually, we're killing 7 people every 60 seconds. It's like, well, hold on a second. Isn't that the biggest killer in America now, like, by far, is the medical system? Like, nothing else comes close. It kills, like, 10 times as many people as smoking.
Well, what do you mean when you say kills people? Is this medical errors that have led to people's deaths?
These are just medical errors. These don't include the things death reactions from properly prescribed drugs or properly performed surgeries that go that have complications and what have you. So it's probably even a lot more than that. Double,
well,
triple,
at some
maybe.
Point, you and I know today we wanted to just kind of talk tech and future and privacy and such. At some point, you and I should probably sit down and have an hour-long heart-to-heart interview about cancer treatments, because I have a lot to say on those things. So I've obviously, as somebody who's a researcher and a truth seeker and someone who's thought outside the box for all of my life, when I was diagnosed with stage 3C breast cancer, which is as bad as it gets before it kills you, I had to do a whole lot to save my own life, and I spent many, many, many months, I don't know, thousands of hours, and so did my husband, researching, reading about all the alternative cancer cures, all the conventional cancer cures, all of the supplementary things that you can do. I mean, we read it all. We did it all. So there's a lot of people out there who think that they know a lot about cancer treatment, but I'll tell you, nothing could even come close to the amount that you quickly learn when you actually have cancer and it becomes your full-time job.
Oh yeah, it's your motivation. You know, like you don't know nothing about survival skills until you actually need to survive. You know,
that's right. So I spent 18 months where cancer was my full-time job, as living, surviving stage 3C breast cancer and 12 lymph nodes that were cancerous. So locally metastatic, locally advanced breast cancer that came really close to killing me. and I was able to fight it back and beat it back by a combination of complementary alternative things and conventional medicine. And here's the thing, you have to wisely wield all the tools at your disposal. And some of the tools in the conventional arsenal are very, very effective. Some of the tools in the alternative arsenal are effective. But I'll tell you, when you put them together, they become way more effective.
Mm.
And it's all, you know, this is not me just pie in the sky. This is me going into it actually with a full expectation that I was not going to do anything conventional. Because like you, I used to think that all the conventional medicine was just cut, burn, and poison to make the Rockefellers rich. When I actually developed cancer, I gave it 4 weeks to try to cut it back with all the natural stuff, and the tumor grew. And it was to the point where if I did not act quickly to get this tumor out of my body, that it would have killed me. And so I acted quickly. I did a lot of conventional things which harm the body, because cancer it's an enemy. And the interesting thing about cancer, unlike any other disease that you can get, you can't treat cancer with kindness. It's the only illness that I can think of that's that way. Like if you have heart disease or diabetes, then just have less stress, eat right, take some antioxidants, do the right thing, lose some weight, get some exercise, make yourself healthy, and that problem will probably go away. But if you have cancer and you do all of those things, the cancer will make itself even stronger, because cancer will take anything you put in your body, antioxidants, protectants, the cancer will take those and say, thank you very much. I'm just going to use that to build a nice little wall around myself so nothing can touch me.
Mm. There's another interesting...
It's a different enemy.
Oh, sorry.
It's a different
Go ahead.
Kind of a disease. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I heard an interesting methodology is that you get a real maple syrup, you know, like Canadian maple syrup, that real thick, gooey stuff, and then you heat it up in a saucepan with a whole bunch of, what's it called, baking soda, I think it was. Baking soda is very alkaline. Cancer doesn't like alkaline, but cancer loves sugar. So if you melt these two together, the cancer absorbs the sugar and then gets injected with the alkaline at the same time, and apparently that's very effective.
Well, so here's the problem. The thing about all of these alternative methods for addressing cancer, the time that I would turn to an alternative method like that instead of things that are actually proven to work, not that that isn't proven to work, but I haven't seen medical studies on it. So the time that I would turn to something like that would be if I either had a stage zero cancer, which is just a little micro growth of cancer that has not yet spread or reached out any kind of tentacles to spread into the body, or if I had a stage four cancer, which is what the conventional medical people will tell you is incurable. And once you hit that point, if you have stage four breast cancer that is actually metastasized to any place else in the body, the bones, the lungs, the liver, the brain, if you have stage four breast cancer, the conventional people, the hospitals will tell you there's nothing we can do for you. We can try to keep you alive for a certain period of time, but you are going to die, and you are going to die of breast cancer.
They throw you into palliative care.
Sooner or later. I'm sorry?
They just throw you into palliative care and go, well, that's you.
Well, what they're doing now, and there's just a new study out on this too, literally like yesterday. What they're doing now is the drugs are actually getting far better at tailoring themselves to these cancers. The kind of breast cancer I had, I received very tailored treatment that was specific to the particular markers. It's almost like personalized medicine, the particular markers on this cancer. So they can keep reducing the tumors over and over and over with various rounds of medications and drugs. Eventually, though, and I've come to the belief that cancer is a sentient entity, that it actually is a consciousness because it is so brilliant at how it subverts and thwarts and goes around everything. So eventually, though, what happens to people with stage four cancer is that the treatments that the conventional doctors give them stop working. And at that point, they will continue to give you chemo if you want it, but it's not going to keep you alive that much longer, and you're going to die miserable from chemo. From cancer, but on chemo, and that's a terrible way to be anyway. So oftentimes in stage four, people will at that point, if they have gotten to stage four, then they'll start looking into clinics in Mexico, or they'll start looking into baking soda or lasers or heating pads and all sorts of other things. So at stage four, you have to say, well, what have you got to lose, really? You don't have anything to lose. The cancer is going to kill you unless you stop it somehow, so why not try everything? The only reason I would say at that point not to try everything is that you'll spend a lot of money and you might burn through your family's inheritance and still die anyway.
Mm.
But if you have a stage 1, 2, or 3 cancer, then I'm adamant about this, Vinny, and again, I'm not a stupid person. I've spent a lot of time researching this, and I didn't originally feel this way until I did thousands of hours of research. If you have a stage 1, 2, or 3 cancer, number one, you must get the tumor out of your body immediately. You have to actually remove that tumor from your flesh. And the reason for that is that you can't, there's no known method that I am aware of that can actually melt away a tumor in virtually all cases. Some people are able to melt them away with certain things, and you say, well, good for them. But across the board, the only thing that universally melts tumors away and causes them to vanish is actual chemotherapy. So the drag with chemotherapy, let me back up. You have to get the tumor out of your body with surgery, and if you can't get it out with surgery, then you have to melt it with chemotherapy. When women receive something called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, which is where instead of doing the surgery first, they do chemo first, their tumors literally melt away. They go from being, let's say, the size of a marble to being gone, or the size of a hen's egg, which is how big my tumor was. If they'd given me chemotherapy, it would have vanished away to the size of a marble. So it literally shrinks tumor tissue. So the first thing, you've got to get the tumor out of your body. But then once it's shrunk away and gone, then you have to deal with the residual tumor cells in other parts of your body. And anytime you've had a tumor in your body, the tumor wants to do, it wants to make its way into your lymphatic system, and then it wants to hitch a ride, almost on like a river system, it wants to hitch a ride through your lymphatic fluid to go into all of these distant parts of your body and ultimately kill you. So you have to get the tumor out so that it's not, that main tumor, whether it's a prostate tumor, a skin cancer tumor, whatever it is, the main tumor is like the mothership sending out little exploring ships that want to get into your bloodstream and land in these distant places. That's how cancer kills you. You don't die from the first tumor. Nobody ever does.
Yeah.
You die from the tumor hitting your lungs, your liver, your brain, your pancreas, or whatever, and destroying that. And that's how you die. So you have to get the mothership out of your body, and the quickest, most efficient way to do that is surgery. Just get it out. Then you have to say, all right, well, now that that's out of my body, what about all those other cells that were kicking around in my lymphatic system? How am I going to get rid of those? That's where chemotherapy comes in. So chemotherapy, this is not neoadjuvant, but adjuvant chemotherapy given after the surgery, goes into your body, and it actually melts away all of those and destroys those individual cancer cells. Now,
it does destroy your immune system. It destroys your immune system at the same time, doesn't it?
Exactly.
So
here's the issue, Vinny. So this is what I'm facing, right? When I have cancer and I've got to save my life. So do I want to do chemotherapy? Well, it's going to destroy your immune system. It makes you sick. It gives you all these side effects, and it harms you. So who wants to do that? Well, the reality is you kind of have to. And let me tell you just really quickly an analogy. So during World War II, the Nazis had taken over Warsaw, Poland. And the Polish people there was the Warsaw Ghetto, but there were also people just sort of hiding out all throughout Warsaw. And what happened was the Allies came in, and instead of sending food and clothing and blankets and medicine into Warsaw, which of course the Nazis would have said thank you and grabbed for their own purposes to make them even stronger to oppress the people in hiding, instead they went in and they carpet bombed the crap out of the Nazis. Because that was the only way to, you couldn't treat them with kindness. And you couldn't get to the people you were trying to help with the kindness because the Nazis would have taken your kindness. That's what cancer does. So after you carpet bomb the crap out of the Nazis and Warsaw is a steaming heap of rubble, then you go in and you rescue the people who are in there that you just liberated. And then you rebuild their city. So cancer is like that. If you were to send, as I said earlier, nice things into your body, the cancer will grab them and say, thank you, that's helpful. That will help me even better fight against the immune system of this body.
Mm.
Cancer is brilliant. And
well, that
evil.
Said, and yes. I think it was 1999, the Australian Medical Institution, I forget the acronym for it, but they did a test on the chemotherapy that they were using to treat various types of cancers, and they concluded that they kill 97% of the people that take chemotherapy.
That's so not true. That's utterly false. That's
Isn't
absolutely not true. I know. I have hundreds and hundreds of friends who have had chemotherapy, because I'm on a message board where we all got diagnosed at the same time. There's a whole group of us who were diagnosed in the same month, and we just kind of stuck together through our whole process online. So I know hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who have been treated with chemotherapy, and they don't die from the chemotherapy. So this is really the problem, and I'd love to write a book about this. I've got two things. I want to write a book about video game addiction and one about cancer treatment. That neither side wants to hear the other. The conventional people, when I tell them about these alternative things that I found that were helping me, they couldn't hear me, even if I had evidence. The alternative people, if I tell them about the fact that chemotherapy really does actually work, they don't want to hear it, even if I have evidence. So it's almost like everybody is blind and deaf and dumb to the reality and the truth of what's happening. And what my husband and I did is we took off the blinders and we said, let's just let the evidence rule and dictate, regardless of our personal feelings or who's saying it or how they're saying it. Let's look at the evidence. And the thing is, chemotherapy saves the lives of virtually everybody who has stage 1, 2, and 3 cancer. It goes in, it kills the cancer. The only downside of it, and there's a couple, right? One downside, it's expensive. Somebody's got to pay for it. Another downside is that it's very harmful to the body. So how do you fix that? My husband and I figured out how to fix that. If you take Coriolis mushroom, for example, your immune system does not decay. The first round of chemotherapy I had of adriamycin and Cytoxan, which are very potent cocktail of chemo drugs, the very first round that I had, I became super sick. And by the second round, I almost had pneumonia because my immune system was so suppressed that I had neutropenia, which means your white blood cell count is just down in the dumps. And you can't fight off even the most minimal infection. I read about neutropenia. I couldn't even eat blue cheese because the spores in the blue cheese could colonize my body. So that's how bad it was. When that happens to a patient in the conventional hospital, they take you in and they give you a shot of something called Neulasta. And Neulasta is $2,500 for one shot, right? And what this Neulasta does is it stimulates the bone marrow and forces it to produce white blood cells. Now, not only is it $2,500, it hurts like hell. Your bones feel like they are absolutely exploding from the inside out, and they give you oxycodone so you can handle the pain of your bone marrow being so stimulated to produce these white blood cells. So what a horrible drug, but yet it does produce the white blood cells. The neutropenia goes away. So my husband did some research after my first Neulasta shot, and I'm screaming in agony, and he says, there's got to be a better way. So he finds out that in Japan, they've taken a mushroom extract, an extract of a mushroom called Coriolis, and they've refined it and put it in the IV bags in the hospital along with the chemotherapy. So now you're getting the chemo, and then they give you an IV bag of this thing called PSK, which is a Coriolis mushroom extract. And those patients never have the white blood cell count drop. The Coriolis mushroom keeps their white blood cells in a normal range, so they can tolerate the chemotherapy, and they don't have to have this horrible Neulasta shot. So my husband then finds the only producer in the United States, in North America, that actually manufactures this Coriolis mushroom. He orders a case of it. He gives me 3 pills every morning, which I dutifully take. And the next time I go into my doctor and she does the blood test and she's expecting to see this neutropenia and give me more Neulasta, she goes, oh, my gosh, your blood cell count is normal. Your white cell count is normal. She said, I can't believe it. Wow. And I said, yeah, it's because I'm taking these mushrooms. And she said, I can't hear you. She didn't want to know. So evidence in front of her eyes, perfectly normal white blood cell counts. Catherine Albrecht, no longer sick with every disease or every infection that came along. And when I said, let me show you the research, let me show you this published, peer-reviewed medical literature research of what they're doing in Japan with this. And she said, no, I don't even want to see it. And I said, why don't you want to see it? She said, well, it's a mushroom. I said, no, look at the evidence. Don't look at this as a mushroom. Look at the evidence. And she wouldn't. So I have this experience all the time. I'm an alternative radio host myself. I belong to the absolute truth community that disbelieves everything that comes down the pike. And yet when I try to tell people chemotherapy saves lives, everybody says, I can't hear you. I can't hear you. Nope, it's cut, burn, poison. They're just trying to kill us. They say, no, look at the evidence. And I can't get people to do it. So I feel like both sides are completely missing the boat. The boat is you look at all the evidence, you look at all the things that can help you, and you pick from the best from conventional medicine, which is literally the best we have right now for fighting cancer. And then you mitigate the effects with the best from the alternative side. So I'll give you another example. I had to have radiation. I'll tell you, Vinny, this cancer was so far spread in my body, it was horrifying. I had to have radiation to make sure that it wouldn't come back. Well, radiation sucks because it burns your skin and it makes you tired. Well, my husband, once again, bless his heart, he went out and did some research and found that resveratrol in very high doses not only protects your skin, but it potentiates, in other words, strengthens the radiation to kill the cancer cells. So I went on a regimen of high doses of resveratrol during the radiation treatment. And as a result, I didn't blister. I didn't get any of those horrible skin problems that other people have. And I very likely knocked out way more cancer than I would have had I not taken resveratrol and just had the radiation alone. So the reality, you can look at the evidence. There is study after study. We have decades of research proving beyond any doubt that radiation therapy destroys cancer cells. No question. It is not even debatable. Mm. But the
is
real
it possible
issue is to tolerate.
Oh, sorry. Continue.
Sorry.
I was just wondering, is it possible to actually shut down people who say otherwise without evidence? Like, let's say I was running a Google search while you were talking, and there's like a couple million results of people from all over the internet citing the study that was done in 2003 by the Australian Medical Study. About the 2 to 3% survival rate of chemotherapy, and then you have a whole bunch of others who say that the survival rate is closer to 60%.
But who are they talking about? Are they talking about stage 4? Because stage 4 has a 3% survival rate regardless of chemotherapy.
Mm. So it might be an obfuscation of statistics and just using the worst case scenario. Like, if you've got a stage 4, your survival rate's 3%.
That is correct. So let me talk survival. So if you take a stage 1 or stage 0 breast cancer and you do nothing at all, you don't do anything, you just ignore it, there is a fairly good chance that the body will simply resolve it. It's not a high chance, but it's a possibility. If the body doesn't resolve it, then the tumor is going to grow and it's going to become a stage 2 and then a stage 3 and then eventually a stage 4. Sometimes it happens really quickly. So at each of these stages, if you simply do surgery and remove the tumor, they have survival statistics on those. If you remove the tumor and you do chemotherapy, we have survival statistics. See, the reality, we're living in the information age. We know what happens to people when they do this. We've been following millions of women who've gone through this for prostate cancer or skin cancer. We've been following millions of people, so we know the outcomes of these various treatments. If you do nothing, then your tumor progresses, you will die. Except for the people who maybe don't. Maybe something changes. Maybe you have a lifestyle change. Who knows what might happen? But the chances are pretty good that if you do nothing, it's going to progress, it's going to metastasize, it's going to kill you.
Well, it's kind of like a war, you know? I mean, if you're going to go fight a war, you need troops on the ground, you need your tanks, you need your planes, you need your supplies, you need your medical staff and all of that kind of jazz. I mean, just putting all your nuts in one basket doesn't sound
like a good idea. It has to become a full-time job, like I was saying.
So, Vinny, let
me tell you what I did, because this will give you a little background. So when I first found a lump in my breast, I went, oh, my gosh, what is this? And it hurt, which is rare. So I was hoping maybe the fact that it hurts means it's not cancer, but I had a bad feeling. So I went to see my natural practitioner who took one look, and she said, look, it's dimpling. That looks like cancer. You better get a mammogram. So I said, well, I've never had one. I don't even believe in mammograms, blah, blah, blah. And I had all my reasons why a mammogram was terrible, all based on the kind of stuff that you hear on alternative radio. And she said, well, Catherine, you really need to get a mammogram, because if it is cancer, it's going to kill you, because this is a big tumor. So I said, okay. So I go in and I get the mammogram, and sure enough, it's cancer. And at that point, Vinny, just to tell you, I'm not some bubble, you know, bobblehead agreeing to everything I'm told by the conventional medical people. I said, well, I'm certainly not. So I'm going to fix this myself. Now, if you're in the fight for your life, you've probably been on a diet before or tried to change your lifestyle, and the habits stay good for a little while and then they drop off. I'll tell you, when you think you're going to die, that's a really good motivator. And so for a month, I said, before they wanted to immediately do surgery and get this out of me and start me on chemo, and I said, no, give me a month to fix this myself. For that month, I slammed baking soda like it was going out of style. For that month, I put poultices on my breast of every kind of thing under the sun. You want to talk about maple syrup and baking soda? Man, I was way beyond that. I did all kinds of stuff. for that month, I meditated. I prayed. I was calm. I listened to uplifting music. I did hypnotherapy. I ate like a saint. I ate nothing but organic vegetable juices and everything that a human being could do. I got 8-9 hours of sleep a night. I did everything right. And at the end of that month, I said, all right, now let's see that tumor. I bet I really knocked it out because I did all these alternative things that everybody says to do. And I went in and I paid out of my own pocket, $700 I paid out of my own pocket because insurance wouldn't cover it, to have a sonogram, an ultrasound, to see how much the tumor had shrunk. And they do the sonogram and they say, Catherine, we hate to tell you this, it hasn't shrunk at all. And I said, what do you mean it hasn't shrunk? I've done everything. It should be melted away by now. They said, no, it hasn't shrunk. If anything, it's bigger. You have to get this thing out of your body because it wants to kill you. So at that point, after doing everything, and I'm saying I should have documented it because it would blow your mind how I did everything right. So at that point, I said, all right, let's get this damn thing out of me then. So I have the surgery. They then tell me that I have these 12 lymph nodes. So it was local, it was advanced, it was metastatic, it was everything else, but it hadn't gone metastatic into distant organs. It wasn't what's called a distant metastasis yet. So I wasn't a lost cause, but I was still pretty bad. And we're doing the research, and what I came to understand from the research, Vinnie, alternative treatments are good as complementary ways to help you survive the conventional treatment. Alternative treatments are good as ways to prevent cancer from getting hold of you in the first place, and alternative treatments are great as a way to prevent a cancer that you've gotten rid of in other ways from ever coming back. But they are terrible for getting rid of cancer that's already gotten a hold of your body. So this is really critical that people understand this, because people are dying because of following the advice of all of these cancer people who go on the radio and they tell you about their alternative care and cite all these statistics. I know, my own aunt, my beloved, wonderful Aunt Rowena, who I love dearly, my favorite aunt, she died of cancer because somebody told her, all you got to do is melt it away with, you know, drink kombucha and eat garlic and do these things. And she did not seek any kind of conventional treatment. She didn't have surgery. She didn't have chemo. By the time she died in agony, screaming in bed, she was riddled with 13 brain tumors in her brain. Her entire liver was eaten up with cancer. Her lungs were riddled with cancer. And it was one of the most horrifying deaths that a human being could ever experience on this planet.
See, and this is why if you're not a medical professional, you can't give medical advice, and nor should you.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, she was going to the kinds of people who claim to be medical professionals, though. And they were telling her, don't cut burning poison. Here's the thing. If you find a lump, let's say you find a small lump in your prostate or a small lump anywhere or a breast lump, and it's the size of a peanut or even the size of a grape, you have to, at that very moment, get yourself, run, don't walk, to your local, whatever cancer facility you have, your local hospital, and say, there's a lump, I'm concerned. And they will tell you if it's cancer or not. And you need to deal with it while it's small, because if you deal with it while it's the size of a peanut or a grape, your chances of surviving with chemotherapy is not 2 to 3%. It's like 97 to 99%. It's really high. It's really, really high. But you have to get it out, and you have to kill the cancer cells. And once you get them out and you kill them, then there's a good chance it won't come back. If you wait, on the other hand, if you try what I did for 4 weeks, which I could just kick myself because I probably was better off before the 4 weeks, if you wait, the thing about cancer, it grows exponentially. So you know how you take two and you multiply it, and eventually it's growing so fast that you can't even keep track of it, right? That exponential growth curve.
Oh, yeah.
So the same thing is true with cancer. If you have a cancer the size of a speck, it's going to take it a long time to get to be the size of a peanut because it's got to make its way up to that. But once it's the size of a peanut, it's going to double. And then once that thing is that size, in the same amount of time, it's going to double. And pretty soon, it grows so quickly that you can't tackle it anymore. So get it when it's small. Don't wait even a minute, even a day. Don't wait. Go immediately and get it checked out and get it out of your body. And at that point, after you've survived the trauma, and it is trauma, I certainly didn't enjoy chemotherapy. It absolutely sucked. I did it for 18 months. My cancer was so far advanced that my oncologist at Dana-Farber down in Boston, one of the best cancer centers in the world, she sees patients from all over the world and has so for years. She told me she gave me more chemotherapy than she's ever given to any patient in her practice. And why did she do that? Because I'm young, relatively speaking, for cancer at least, and because the cancer was so far advanced and I was so on the edge of having it go metastatic that she wanted to beat it back with everything she could. And here's the amazing part. Had I not had that chemotherapy and that radiation, there is a 98% chance that I would currently be dead. And we know this because other women with 6-centimeter tumors and 12 positive lymph nodes who do not get treatment are typically dead within 2 to 5 years. So my chances of survival would have been less than, I think it's like 0.07%, 0.7% would have been my chances of survival had I not received treatment. With the treatment that I received, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, I did all three. With the treatment that I received, my chances now of survival go way up to like 70 to 80% instead of 0.07%. So that's worth it to me to say I'll tolerate a year and a half of crap, which is what it was, going through chemo and losing my hair and my eyelashes and feeling like garbage. And, you know, chemo's no fun. It is poison, I'll admit it. But the poison killed the cancer, and I could build myself back. If I hadn't have killed the cancer would have killed me. And I would have died poison-free, but I would have died of an even worse enemy than poison, which is cancer. Mm. And I'll tell you, there's no more nasty enemy that you could ever go up against than cancer. And you fight it with everything you can, as hard as you can. You don't fight it with wimpy baking soda. I'm really sorry to say that, but yeah. You don't. You don't fight it with lemon juice. You don't fight it with vitamin C. You fight it with poison because we've tested the vitamin C. In stage 4, where nothing else has worked, why not? You could give it a shot.
You're talking intravenous 50 grams of vitamin C, or are you talking about supplements of it? Yeah,
I'm talking about both.
Because we had a guy in New Zealand here who had probably the worst case of swine flu that we had in this country. And when he was on the ECMO machine, they also scanned him and found out that he had hairy cell leukemia. Then they started him on the intravenous vitamin C, and a couple of weeks to a couple of months later, not only did he not have swine flu anymore, but he didn't have that hairy cell leukemia either.
Let's talk about the weight of empirical evidence, because here this is actually a really critical point. So anytime you talk about anything, cannabis, vitamin C. Name the treatment, the alternative treatment. Anytime you talk about it, people will always tell you, well, I know somebody who did X, and look what happened to them. The websites that you go to promoting these various treatments will say, look at these three testimonials of these three patients who were dying, they did this treatment, and now they're thriving and they're cancer-free, right? So we've all seen this.
Well, this one was on 60 Minutes, but yeah.
Right. Well, and we can go into that one, but I just want to talk more generically about the kinds of general claims that people make for general cancer treatment. So we can put the vitamin C into the side for just a second. So the difference between the testimonial-based evidence and the research-based, peer-reviewed, clinical, double-blind trial evidence is really vast. Because what you want to know is if you take 100 people who have hairy cell leukemia, and you take those 100 people and you give them all intravenous vitamin C, how many will respond by being, quote, cured? How many are going to get cured by that cure? So if you take 100 people with this disease and you give them all, let's just take one example, 100 people, and you give 100 people chemotherapy and you give 100 people intravenous vitamin C. I don't know the answer to this because I don't have the statistics in front of me, but let's just make a hypothetical case. Let's say that when you give 100 people chemotherapy who have hairy cell leukemia, 60 of them go into remission, and 40 of them continue to get worse and die. Now you take 100 people and you give them intravenous vitamin C, and 5 of them miraculously get better, and 95% of them get worse and die. I'm not saying that these are the right numbers. I'm making this up. But let's say if that were to happen, In a peer-reviewed scientific journal, they would say some patients, a very small number, showed improvement with the vitamin C treatment. The majority did not show improvement. In the testimonial world, where they don't have to report all those other statistics of the times it failed, they would say, look at these five case studies. Here's Jane Thompson, and she was dying of hairy cell leukemia, and she got vitamin C, and it cured her. Look, and it would be true. But when you are facing hairy cell leukemia, which of those two treatments do you want to do? The one with the testimony with the five smiling people? And by the way, the people who then have the five smiling people for their testimonial will then point to the 40 people who died with the chemotherapy and say, look, chemotherapy killed these 40 people, failed to save them. But look at these five smiling testimonials who were saved by our treatment.
Oh, yeah.
So the critical thing here when you're evaluating cancer treatments, if this were anything else, I wouldn't even spend this time on it because whatever. But we're talking about people's lives. And the critical thing in evaluating a cancer treatment, in saving people's lives or not, in putting people's lives at risk if you recommend the wrong thing, you need to look at the study of what's the big picture look like for this treatment. Not for this one guy whose life was over and then he was saved, but what's the big picture for all the people who get the treatment. And what you'll find is that in almost every case, these alternative treatments that are touted on the Internet with testimonials do not do the double-blind placebo-controlled trials that will give you those answers, and they never tell you, like all these clinics in Mexico that have websites, they'll never tell you about the 90 patients that died. They'll tell you about the three that thrived. And the reality is
it's out a of sales pitch.
H4 breast cancer. I'm sorry?
Well, basically, they're just giving you a sales pitch, you know, buy our product.
That's right. That's right. So listen, if you took 100 women with stage 4 breast cancer, stage 4, deadly. They're going to be dead. There's a 97% chance, or out of the 100 women, 97 of them will be dead within 3 to 5 years, typically sooner. What if you took your treatment, and let's say my treatment was I'm going to wave my magic feather over all 100 of them, and my magic feather does absolutely nothing, but I'm going to claim it does. 3 of those women are going to survive anyway. And when I'm done waving the magic feather, if I fail to tell you about the 97 who just died, but I only tell you about the 3 who thrived, and then I try to sell you my magic feather treatment for $10,000, everybody under the sun is going to want to buy it. See, this is why science, it's so important that people understand the scientific method. And as much as you might not like scientists, you might not like the pharmaceutical industry, and there's a whole lot of reasons not to, there's really good reasons to look at evidence-based treatments for cancer instead of testimonial-based treatments for cancer. And if there's one thing I can communicate to all your listeners who I know are learning about this, don't base any decision for any medical treatment on cancer based on testimonials alone, because it is all too easy to find the one exception who's going to survive and not tell you about the 97 who died when they did that treatment. And my aunt is a perfect case in point.
You totally need registered double-blind medical trials with backgrounds and the whole mass of studies and things of that nature. And I think Dr. Thomas Levy, who's also a lawyer, I think he came to New Zealand when we had this big 60-minute story about the guy who got his hairy cell leukemia and swine flu disappear because of intravenous vitamin C. And he revealed that there's actually been a 75-year history, including by Nobel Prize winners and what have you, actually verifying the efficacy of this basically being used against almost any virus. And it's interesting you said earlier that cancer's conscious, right? It has a consciousness.
Well, that's just my belief. That's not scientific. That's just Catherine Albrecht's personal opinion, but yes.
Well, what that reminds me of is a book that was written called Dr. Mary's Monkey about this this girl who was incidentally going out with, I think, Lee Harvey Oswald at the time. She got advanced through her high school, university, all the way into the lab, because I think when she was in a high school lab, she managed to create a cancer virus. And the U.S. Government recruited her and gave her these skips ahead. You know, it's like, do you want to go straight to university at the age of 16 and skip the rest of high school? She's like, yeah. You want to skip the next few years of university and then go straight into a lab with your own team and everything? And you're like, yeah. So she develops this massive cancer virus that is so freaking deadly. And apparently it turns up in all the vaccines and everything. And hey, presto, we've got between 1 in 3 and a 1 in 2 cancer rate. So I'm of the opinion that cancer's not just a disease, it's an engineered bioweapon.
Well, the only thing, though, about cancer is it's been around with humanity for all of history. We've seen cancer in mummies that have been exhumed from Egyptian tombs. We see cancer in the animal kingdom. We see cancer in wild animals.
But do we see it at rates of 1 in...
natural diet.
Yeah, but do we see it in rates of 1 in 2 and 1 in 3?
Oh, do we see what?
Do we see cancer rates in mummies and animals at rates of 1 in 2 or 1 in 3, though?
No, we don't. But here's the thing. If it were engineered, then we wouldn't see so much of it. Well, we'd see a lot of it now, but we wouldn't see any of it prior to the ability to engineer stuff. So we know that cancer's always been with humanity. It's been in the oldest, most ancient Greek and Roman writings of doctors and physicians back then. Cancer's always been with us. It's experiencing a huge increase because the things that fuel and feed cancer, especially the reproductive endocrine-based cancers that affect the prostate, the breast, the uterus, the ovaries, those kinds of cancers are increasing at a tremendous pace because of all the estrogenics in our society.
Do you believe that that's a deliberate a part of the New World Order agenda?
I do. So I'll say something very controversial here, that I believe that the wholesale introduction of soy into the human diet in almost every country on the globe was very specifically engineered by a man named Dwayne Andreas. He's the head of Archer Daniels Midland, or was for many years. And he traveled around the globe to take a toxic food that no human society has ever eaten in any quantity, which is soy, and turn it not only from a toxic food that nobody would touch, but turn it into a staple that is now the most commonly consumed oil on planet Earth, that now finds its way into virtually every food that people eat if they're eating processed foods. So what does that mean? Well, we know that soy is extremely estrogenic. And when I say extremely estrogenic, if you were to give a baby, infant formula made from soy, it's the equivalent of giving them a birth control pill a day. It's that estrogenic. So soy, being one of the most estrogenic foods that a human being can consume, has now been made a part of our diet, and we've been sold this bill of goods that it's actually a health food. Well, when men consume soy, it immediately reduces their testosterone level. How interesting. Well, that would make them less aggressive, wouldn't it? This is the reason why in prisons, there's been lawsuits actually in Ohio and elsewhere against the prisons, because they're feeding the men, instead of feeding them meat, they're feeding them soy protein artificial substitutes for meat, which is causing them all kinds of endocrine disruption, health problems, and is making them very docile. If men consume large quantities of soy, they stop growing beards. If men consume large quantities of soy, they become effeminate, because estrogen is a feminizing chemical. It's a feminizing hormone that reduces male testosterone. So a couple of years ago, I was talking about this on my own radio show, kmashow.com, if people want to check it out. But I was talking about the soy problem in men. And I had a listener contact me afterwards, and he said, you know, Catherine, you might have saved me, because I went to Sam's Club or whatever big wholesale club, and I bought a huge case of soy milk. And I was consuming it every day because I thought it was healthy. He said, it's weird, though. I've always been a really hairy, you know, Mediterranean kind of guy, and I've had to shave not only in the morning, but I have a 5 o'clock shadow. I have to shave before I go out to dinner. He said, after I was drinking the soy for a couple of months, I stopped having to shave every night, and then it got to the point where I only had to shave 3 times a week. My beard just stopped growing in. He said, and then I started noticing I was developing breasts. So we've all seen these guys, right, the man boobs, where you see guys and you're like, dude, what's that? They could very well be that person is consuming large quantities of estrogenics. So he said, once I heard your radio show and I stopped consuming the soy, the man boobs went away and I was able to start shaving again on a daily basis, and my beard came back. And he said, and what's more, I felt like my virility, my maleness came back. So we all know, everybody knows vegetarian men. It's kind of a stereotype, right? They're kind of wimpy. Well, there's a reason for that, because they're sucking down the soy, and they're replacing all of the normal substances that you should be eating to get protein. They're replacing this with this estrogenic substance. Now, I've had women say, well, then isn't that good for us because we're women? Don't we want to be more womanly? Nothing could be further from the truth. 80% of breast cancers consume soy, consume estrogen as a fuel. So if you're eating lots of soy, if you have even a couple of breast cancer cells in your breast and you're eating soy, those breast cancer cells are going to use it like gangbusters, like Miracle-Gro. So the more estrogen that we are consuming in our diets, it is causing women to develop all kinds of reproductive cancers. It's causing men to develop reproductive cancers, and it's causing men to become effeminized, which is exactly what the global leaders would want from a population of angry men, would be for them to be so passive and wimped out that they couldn't do anything and turn into a bunch of pansy women. And it would also, here's the other thing about it. If you do the research, you will find that when they give soy to hamsters, they did this in Europe, that after a couple of generations, the hamsters, their fertility drops and drops and drops, and after the fourth or fifth generation, they're sterile. So the men can no longer impregnate, the males can no longer impregnate the females, and the females, to the extent that they do have babies, their babies have shriveled, if they're male, have shriveled testicles and genitalia that doesn't really even function. So this is, when we're seeing this rash of infertility, right? We've got all these fertility clinics and blah, blah, blah. We're seeing a rash of infertility. We're seeing a rash of miscarriages. We're seeing people having more and more difficulty to conceive. And this is all because of the stuff that we're eating. So do I think it's intentional? I have to say, based on what we know about soy, no society in their right mind would be feeding this to their population unless they wanted to make them weak, effeminate, and infertile. And so if it's not a conspiracy, it may as well be, because you've got Duane Andreas. He's the biggest political donor in history. You can read about him on Wikipedia even, Duane Andreas. And he traveled all over the world, even went behind the Iron Curtain back when we were enemies with them, and he pumped this soy oil as a food to everybody. Now it's the number one consumed oil in Mexico, in Thailand, in Canada, in Jamaica, in the U.S., in the Ukraine. Soy is everywhere now. And do you know that it was back in the 1930s, I did a bunch of research on the history of soy. Back in the 1930s, there were these guys in America who decided they were going to...
I was going to say, you're back in the 1930s, I did this study. It's like, Catherine, you're not that old.
No. No, these guys in the 30s were trying to, they came up with this business idea that they were going to take this soy, which wasn't even used for animal food because it makes animals infertile. And so farmers wouldn't even give it to their animals. It was an ingredient for making paint. That's what soy was used for, but it was an industrial plant. So they somehow came up with this way of refining the soy and taking the poison out of it and trying to sell it. They realized they couldn't sell it. They tried to give it away, and nobody would take it. So you go from that era where they thought they were going to get rich from taking this like byproduct of making paint and sell it as a food, and nobody would even take it for free, to the point where today it's touted as a health food, and it is in virtually everything you eat.
Yeah.
It's in salad dressing. It's in margarine. It's in ice cream. It's in mayonnaise. If you eat a sandwich at your local sandwich shop, it's going to have either oil on it that's soy. If you eat French fries, they're fried in soybean oil. Every fried food that you eat at every restaurant you go to is fried in soybean oil.
Either that or... either soybean oil or canola oil, which was used as an industrial engine lubricant, which also is not good for you either.
That's right. And we know that canola oil has actually been associated with heart lesions. So these are two, and by the way, both of them are genetically modified. About 98% of the soy consumed in the United States is genetically modified soy.
Mm.
So you add in now the genetic modification, the glyphosates that they're sprayed with, all that other stuff, and you're winding up with something that's quite toxic.
Mm.
So now a lot of people will say, well, what about the Asians? Don't they eat soy sauce? Yes. If you ferment the soy, you destroy the estrogen, which is very interesting. So soy sauce, which is fermented soybeans, is actually, it's slightly estrogenic, but it's nowhere near soy milk or tofu. The edamame, you know, the little soybeans that you can eat in a Japanese restaurant, that's just pure unadulterated soybeans. Don't eat them. They're very delicious. I love them, but they're very bad for you.
When we look at the facts of these of soy and the contamination of the food supply through GMOs and everything, people assume the intention first and then they go look for the evidence. Well, I think that if you look at the results of what's been happening to the food supply, I think the intention becomes quite clear.
Let me tell you something else, and I'll give you one more piece of evidence. And now it's going to blow your mind. You're not going to be able to not think about this. You know, all of this rise in homosexuality and in transgender and bisexual and gender identity issues that people across the globe seem to be experiencing right now?
Oh, totally.
That's exactly what you would expect if you were to douse people in gender-bending chemicals like soy. Because if you're a man, the thing that makes you a man and desire a woman is the testosterone and hormone levels in your body. If you take a functional man and you remove the testosterone from his body and replace it with estrogen, he will become very gender confused. If you take a normal woman and you begin messing with the chemicals in her body, she becomes slightly less confused. It seems to have a bigger impact on men. But you can also generate some of these kinds of gender difficulties in women as well. So there's a guy in Japan. This is one of the grossest stories. He actually cut off his own genitalia and then cooked it up in a meal and invited people to come and partake of this meal for, I don't know, $10,000 a piece, some crazy amount of money. And he was arrested not for cutting off his genitalia because he was out of his mind. He was arrested for serving potentially unsanitary food for a cost, for pay, that hadn't been government approved. So what I found interesting about this guy, aside from the fact that that's just crazy, was when he was interviewed, he said, I didn't cut off my male parts because I wanted to be a woman. He said, I really don't feel like I have any gender. In fact, I feel like I have no sex at all. And I just wanted to be neutral. So that's just one guy in Japan, but we're hearing this over and over and over and over. All the young people are reporting this, that not all of them, but many of them are reporting the same thing of not really having a clear sexual orientation. Not really clearly knowing who they're attracted to or not attracted to. Well, all of that attracted to or not attracted to, that is all driven by sex hormones. It is the actual hormones in our body. That's why when you're you know, seven, you don't think about sex because you don't have any hormones in you to make you think about sex. When you're 15, the reason all you can think about is sex is you're being flooded with hormones that are making you think about sex. So when you mess with that, And no longer do those hormones flow in a normal way. When you think about sex, it's all in your head. You're just going to imagine, I don't know, well, let me decide which one I want to be. So it becomes less a matter of biological drive that makes people normal men and women, and it becomes more an issue of societal preference. What do you want to be? I don't know. You want to be both? You want to be either one? So this is why we are seeing this immense explosion of gender confusion and shifting gender roles in our society, and not just gender, but sexual roles shifting in our society. Totally. All this stuff that they've put in our food.
Yeah. And of course, if you tell people this, they say, you're homophobic, don't they? Because I don't know about you, but I think there's an agenda to facilitate this somehow, some reason, right? Strong, masculine men don't take stuff lying down, right? They fight, they kill,
yeah,
and that kind of thing. Whereas if you're totally gender bent and what have you, your ability to get angry, enraged, and so on and so forth, resist the New World Order, so on and so forth, doesn't freaking exist anymore. You just lie down and take it.
Right. That's right. Or you just play another video game, you just pop another beer, just have another Hot Pocket or another thing, French fries. You know, it's really, if you provoke or put into a dangerous situation men with varying levels of testosterone, the men with the highest levels of testosterone will respond the most aggressively. Now, whether that's good or bad, I don't know. Maybe in a city kind of environment, it's different from in the country. Maybe we don't need men responding aggressively. I don't know. But I will say this, it is exactly a one-to-one correspondence. One of the clearest correspondences in all of scientific literature is the correspondence between testosterone and aggression. So if you remove that testosterone, you remove the aggression. If you increase the testosterone, you increase the aggression. And obviously, you don't want to be surrounded by a whole bunch of aggressive males, but on the other hand, you don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of men who, if they are pushed around, and if the government does become corrupt and start taking away their health care and their jobs and their money and their independence and their dignity, you don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of men who will say, oh, okay, oh, just don't hurt me. You want some men who grow some cojones and say, no, heck no, you can't do that. So you asked me if I think it's a conspiracy. I do. I take a look at what Dwayne Andreas did and how he was able to perpetuate or propagate the use of soy across the whole planet. And you look at his background and who his political cronies were and what people in the very highest levels of banking and political power he answers to, then all of a sudden it all just comes into focus.
What would you say is the end game here? I mean, intention. I mean, are we going to be, I don't know, a species of transgender people, you know, for lack of a better definition?
I think the end point of all of this is they're going to get us to not even want to have bodies anymore and get us to take chips into our bodies and have neural implants and neural connections to the global brain. That's what I think is going to happen. I think eventually that Oculus Rift that I was telling you about, which makes it feel as though you're living in a virtual reality, I think that's where they want us to go. To where you don't even care about this physical body any longer, but you'll just upload your soul into the Matrix for safekeeping.
Yeah, that's exactly what it made me think of, is the Matrix there. Just make sure that nobody has any perception of reality or whatsoever. And I think this is another part of the New Age religion. Have you heard about all of this kind of stuff popping up everywhere?
Oh, yeah, and, you know, I think it's going to all tie in ultimately, this idea that we're all going to reach global consciousness, we're going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and sail off into the stars together. You know, this is the mark of the beast. This is straight out of the Bible. This is where people will get to the point where they're going to bow down and worship something in order to have a perception of immortality. And we're seeing that. We're seeing people already promising that. Google is saying that they're going to be able to cheat death and make you immortal. How are they going to do that? Well, they're going to do that by taking you and uploading you into the computer mainframe. And then this body thing that you have that's such a pain and you have to wash it and exercise it and take care of it, you can just dump it. You can just let it die. You know, you think about people playing video games all day. I don't know about you. I've met some World of Warcraft addicts who will spend 18, 20 hours a day playing the game. And they, when they have to unplug and look at the real world isn't looking so good for them. They're fat, they stink, they're surrounded by pizza boxes, their wives have left them, they've lost their jobs, they have no income, everything in their real life is terrible. And so that gives them even more incentive to just plug back into the game, because in the game they're strong and they're healthy and they're winning and everybody likes them and they have gold and swords and armor. And so obviously faced with those two choices, do you want to be some fat loser with nothing going for you, or do you want to be some, you know, dashing, handsome, amazing dude in the game? And eventually it's going to get to the point where you're going to have the option, and this is what I think is taking the mark of the beast, you're going to have the option of saying, forget it, I give up my mortal life. Go ahead, let me die, but let me live forever in this virtual reality. And I think that's going to be hell. I think that is hell. So there's my crazy thought.
A permanent fantasy world for all the people who are stupid enough to think that reality doesn't actually have value.
That's right.
Nor their own lives.
And once you get in there, you better believe, because it's very clear biblically that it's a deception. Once you get in there, then the torture begins. Once they own you, once the dark side owns you, body, mind, and soul, it's not going to continue to give you the nice things. It's going to give you the garbage. You know the old joke about the politician?
Is that you change, what was it, they're like diapers, you change them regularly because for the same reason?
Oh, no, I heard that one. No, this is a politician, he dies. And he gets to the pearly gates, and St. Peter says, you're going to have two choices. We're going to send you down to hell, and you're going to try that for a day. We'll send you up here to heaven, you'll try that for a day, and then you can pick which one you want. So he gets to heaven, and it's nice. You know, he's playing harps, and there's music, and it's all calm and peaceful. But he says, all right, let me try hell. He gets down to hell, and it's a huge party, and the devil says, hey, come on in, and there's beautiful women, and he's playing golf, and he's got a Maserati. And he's just having a great time. Everything there is fabulous. All right, so the day ends. He goes back and he says to St. Peter. St. Peter says, "What's your choice?" He says, "You know, I always thought I wanted to go to heaven, but I think I'll take hell. It's a lot more fun." So he goes, "Okay, boom." All of a sudden, the guy finds himself. He's in hell. He's in molten lava up to his neck, steam and screams everywhere. The souls of the damned screaming all around him. He's in agony. And the devil comes by and he says, What happened? What happened yesterday? It was so nice here." The devil says, "Oh, yeah, well, yesterday we were campaigning."
Yeah, it sounds about right, doesn't it?
He said, "Yesterday we were campaigning. Today you voted for me."
Well, I think that's kind of the way of the world. And I wanted to go back to something you said actually in the beginning of the broadcast is about how we now have this massive increase of knowledge. You know, anything you want, you can now have access to. And it reminded me of the economic standpoint is that as soon as one particular resource is totally abundant, suddenly it loses all of its value. So despite the fact that we're now swimming in available knowledge, nobody even wants it because there's just enough. There's enough of it, and they can get it for free, so it loses its value.
Yeah, no, I think there's a real point to that, and this is why they're going into getting more and more invasive kinds of information. This is why they want to read your email and read what you search for and track you around and put trackers on your phone because, you know, regular knowledge just isn't good enough. We want the intimate knowledge that we wouldn't have otherwise. So now we're starting to get into kind of perverse forms of wanting to know really intimate details about people. And that's being driven by the corporate sector and the government sector, but eventually it's going to make its way into all of our lives where we're going to expect to be able to have that kind of access to information about each other.
Well, yeah. I mean, social media and these networking platforms have found, I mean, I will, let's say, for example, take myself, I've got two people who I would call my best friends that I hang out with, and maybe 100 acquaintances or so in the real world. And, you know, there's my wife and so on and so forth. And then on Facebook, there are hundreds of people that I interact with and thousands of acquaintances, right? And what occurs to me is that I spend far more time with these distant digital acquaintances than I do with my real world peeps. So again, it's like the availability. You've got so much social interaction available online that you no longer want real social interaction. And in so doing, you can't hug people. You can't read body language. You can't do any of this thing. I mean, everybody gets into fights all the time on the internet because somebody says something, and because you can't hear the tone of their voice, see their body language or something, you completely misinterpret it and go nuts at them when they were actually trying to give you a compliment.
Yes, exactly. That is a good point. So I don't know. I'm of the belief that we need to pull ourselves out of this virtual world, which is so compelling and so addictive, and really take back those 16 hours a day or 11 hours a day, the 70% of our time that we're spending staring into screens, and actually start interacting with real people and doing real things again. So that when they come along and say, "Hey, just dump your real life," you'll say, "No, my real life's great. Why would I want to get rid of this?" Instead of spending all our time in the virtual world to where your real life falls apart, you don't have any friends, those couple of friends you have you no longer see anymore, and all your friends are in this virtual world. And then when somebody comes along and says, "Hey, dump your body, dump your real life, and live in the virtual world," you say, "Well, I practically already am, so okay." That sounds good. So I just think we need to regain our appreciation of the actual real world that we live in and start living in it again. And get out of all of this fakeness that's just wasting our time and destroying our relationships and us.
Yeah, somebody asked me the other week, Catherine, what the hell did people do without cell phones? And I say, well, they would turn up at their mate's house, and their mate, instead of going, "Oh my God, why didn't you text me before you come over," and get really pissed off at their friend, they'd be like, "Oh my God, it's my friend," and invite you in and have a coffee or something.
That's a good point. It's so true, yeah. Well, and we're the last generation to remember how it was before all this stuff. You know, the smartphone's only been around 7-8 years. Prior to that, people didn't carry around these phones all the time. So the fact that people can't remember what it was like before that, give me a break.
Yeah, people used to be smart, and the phones used to be people used to be smart, the phones used to be dumb, and now it's the reverse.
That's perfectly stated. Couldn't agree with you more. So, well, this has been really fun. Thank you for letting me talk about cancer and technology and soy and all my favorite topics. I always have a blast talking to you.
Let you. You couldn't be stopped.
I know. had to get it out of my system.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I find what the Cancer Society does is they find people who are survivors of cancer, or they find people who've got relatives who have died of cancer, because they're the ones who are most passionate about it. However, the Cancer Society, to my mind, is like, isn't that kind of a bit manipulative? How many cures have you produced for cancer, Cancer Society? None. Do you produce cancer-causing sunscreen, though, and tell people to slather it all over themselves in order to prevent themselves from getting cancer so that the nanoparticulized aluminium goes through their pores and gives them cancer? Well, yes, we do. And do you make money off of that? Well, yes, we do. And you pay all your employees? Yep. So...
Yeah, that's a really good point.
You've been around for 40 years as the Cancer Society, never come up with a single cure. Okay, now, if I was a builder, and you ask me, what do you do for a living? I say, I'm a builder. Really? How many things have you built? Well, in 40 years, I've built absolutely nothing, ever, in any way, shape, or form. Would you think I was actually a builder? No, you'd think I was full of crap, wouldn't you? and then I'm just deceiving you for my own personal benefit in some way, shape, or form. So I could come up with some kind of a fake contract to say, hey, I'm going to build this house for you, give me the money up front, and then skip town.
Well, maybe I'm just being cynical.
Maybe I'm just being cynical.
Well, the thing about... some of the cancer charities, they're trying to provide support for people who've been diagnosed. The funding that they raise and contribute for medical research, I know the Susan G. Komen Foundation, which I have a lot of reasons not to really like, but they've done some good things. They've contributed a lot of money to cancer research that probably has helped to fund some of the breakthroughs that have happened. So I won't say it's entirely useless what they do. They've certainly helped raise awareness. You know, in the 1970s, this is in The Emperor of All Maladies, in that book, which is a really good overview of cancer and the fight against it over all these years. But in that book, they tell the story of a woman, a socialite, who wanted to have a support group for breast cancer patients or breast cancer survivors. And she posted the ad with the classified department at the New York Times, and they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't run the ad because we can't say the word breast in print and we can't say the word cancer in print. So in the 1970s, you couldn't say either one. If you were diagnosed with breast cancer, you couldn't tell people what you had. It just wasn't talked about in polite society, apparently. And they wanted to say that there would be a meeting. They suggested alternative language, that there could be a meeting for women with diseases of the chest area. So instead of saying breast cancer. So I think in part it is the American Cancer Society, the Susan G. Komen Foundation, all the other cancer societies that really have, I think, at least raised awareness so we can talk about the issue, so we have more understanding of what to look for and how to diagnose it and how to self, perform self-exams. And
of course, they're not out there. They're not out there telling people, hey, by the way, eating all those soy and processed foods and all of that stuff causes cancer and everything, because that would just threaten the major evil Monsanto agribusiness.
I agree completely. That's a really tough message to get out there, because all the media through which you would spread such a message are funded by those very same people. So if Coca-Cola is your number one advertiser, you can't go doing lots of exposés on how corn syrup is bad for you. You can't do it. So you gotta get your news from sources that aren't funded by the major players, because that's the place where people have the guts to tell you the truth and not worry about losing an advertising contract or making some golf partner angry or losing their spot on the council and foreign relations seat. You know, you got to find people who don't have those things at stake and who aren't vested in those interests. So,
or breasted in them.
Yeah, thank you. So I actually need to run. I've so enjoyed talking to you. I went about double what I had planned to say.
Yeah, roughly, yeah.
Yeah.
You just got carried away.
I know it. Where can people hear this broadcast so I can let my radio listeners know to tune in?
Well, let's wrap up the show then. It's thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, ladies and gentlemen. Is Vinny with a Y? Because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, there are a bank account there and a couple of PayPal buttons. This is 100% listener-supported broadcasting. I'm one of the few that hasn't got advertisers and is totally supported of, by, and for the people. And this is part of the reason why there is such a massive diversity of guests, all the way from people you never heard about to people you hear from all the time and just want to listen to more. People like Catherine, for instance. So, yeah, other than that, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Thank you, Catherine, for participating. And quickly, rattle off a few of your websites and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah, so I do a daily radio show every afternoon, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. You can find that at kmashow.com or just my name, KatherineAlbrecht.com. I also help to create the world's most private search engine that you should be using instead of Google if you don't want to be having all of your personal information go into the Matrix and to the NSA, et cetera. You can go to startpage.com and use it instead of Google. We submit your searches to Google for you. They never see you, they only see us, and then we get the results and give them to you privately. We strip out all the tracking cookies, and then we forget we ever saw you. We delete all records of your visit, including your IP address. We have new email coming out at startmail.com. We've been working for about 3 years to build from the ground up totally private encrypted email that's so easy to use that even a beginner can do it. It is the only fully private PGP encrypted email that anyone can use. Total piece of cake, startmail.com. There's a 2-minute video. You can familiarize yourself with what it is. And if you mention at the bottom, there's a little form there, it's going to be available by invitation only. We're rolling out 50,000 accounts to beta testers who pre-signed up. And then after that, it's going to go into invitation only status. So if you would like to get an invitation, go to startmail.com. At the bottom, you'll see a form. Go ahead and fill it out for to receive your invitation. Mention the Vinnie Eastwood Show and my name, Catherine Albrecht. And when we go into the invitation phase of rolling out accounts, which will be this summer, then you will get an invitation for a StartMail account. You can pass that invitation along to somebody else. You can delete it if you don't want to take the account. You can sign up as many friends as you would like during this invitation phase, and they'll also get an invitation. But when those invitations are gone, then we'll be moving to yet another phase. StartMail will be paid, just to clarify. Somebody's got to pay the bills. If it's not the advertisers and the spies, then it's got to be you. It's $5 a month, which we think is actually quite affordable for totally private email that even we can't read. So that's startmail.com, startpage.com, the search engine, and, of course, my website, kmashow.com.
All right. And, ladies and gentlemen, when that comes out released, there's going to be a nice little jingle to advertise it called Walk Like an Encryption. All right. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for your attention and your donations. And just stay classy, San Diego. We'll see you again sometime. To believe.